तुंजा बिहारे। जय राधा माधव तुंज बिहारे। गोपी चंद पाल गिरधर धारे। गोपी चंद पाल गिरधर धारे। यशोर नंदन व्रज जन रंजन। यशोर नंदन व्रज जन रंजन। यमुन तीरवन चाहरे। यमुन तीरवन चाहरे। जय राधा माधव तुंज बिहारे। जय राधा माधव तुंज बिहारे।
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parabrajagachara Sotara Sutta Shri Shrimad Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki ISKCON Founder Chari Srila Prabhupada Ki Samvedakta Vrinda Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai Gaur Premananda. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Simple Devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Garanga. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Pastai Buddha Sri Mati Bhakti Vananta Swamini Kinamane Namaste Sarasadarim Gauravana Pacharne Nirvishesha Shunni Vari Pastachari Sitarane. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, of course, on Sunday we usually start with the Bhagavad Gita verse and discuss that, but I want to give a little prelude or introduction before I read a verse here, so we can sort of understand the context where this comes. In 1981, some of the older devotees might remember this because it was kind of an interesting topic at the time. There was a rabbi, Harold Kushner, and he wrote this best-selling book. It was called Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Now, this isn't a new idea, but somehow it revived some interest in this, and he sold 4 million copies of this. And basically what he talked about was a philosophical principle or concept called theodicy. Which I just learned about. So theodicy is talking about the conundrum or the question of why the universe, if it's created and governed by a God who is good and has a loving nature, nevertheless, why is there so much suffering and pain? Essentially, this is what philosophers talk about, the evidential problem of evil. In other words, why does God allow evil? And this has been discussed for centuries, back from the Greeks through Christian theologians and philosophers. And often they don't come up with a very good explanation. In fact, many of the Christian philosophers have come to the conclusion that if God is all good, then he must not be all powerful. Otherwise, why would he possibly allow people to suffer and allow evil in the world? So he must be limited in his power. Now, of course, that's not real satisfying in many ways. And so this has been discussed in so many different arenas. But I think it's a very important and valuable question, and it's actually fairly complex when you get into it. But fortunately, we have the wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, and Srila Prabhupada. And so for us, it's actually not that difficult of a question. The question of, is God all good? And if all, is he all, is he just? And if so, is he all powerful? Or conversely, that if he has all power, can he still be just and kind? Here's that's what I'm going to talk about today, but the spoiler answer here is yes. Krishna is both omnipotent, all-powerful, and he is all-just and all-kind. So I have a number of verses that I'm going to try to cover today. I hope no one's in a hurry to get to Prashanam. No. I've got 7 or 8 verses I actually want to read from the Bhagavad Gita, at least parts of them, that because there's several steps in sort of this philosophical progression, understanding this concept. But there's one particular purport that I thought was really good that I like. Well, of course, they're all good. But in this one, 515, Srila Prabhupada sort of outlines the whole process and gives the basic answer. And then we'll elaborate from there. So I'll read this. 515, Bhagavad Gita. Let's see. Nadate kashachit papam nachaiva sukritim vabhu. Agyane navritam jnanam tena muyanti jantava. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. Now, this isn't, on its surface, a real easy verse. At least, I didn't think so to understand exactly what it's saying. What does it mean the Lord does not assume someone's sinful or pious activities? So, Prabhupada will explain. Report. The Sanskrit word vibhu means the Supreme Lord who is full of unlimited knowledge, riches, strength, fame, beauty, and renunciation, 6 opulences. He is always satisfied in himself, undisturbed by sinful or pious activities. He does not create a particular situation for any living entity, but the living entity, bewildered by ignorance, desires to be put into certain conditions of life, and thereby his chain of action and reaction begins. A living entity is by superior nature full of knowledge. In other words, we are part of the superior energy of the Lord, unlike Prakriti or dull matter. A living entity, nevertheless, he's prone to be influenced by the ignorance due to his limited power. We are tatashta shakti, limited. The Lord is omnipotent, and we're talking about is God all-powerful? Yes, he is. But the living entity is not. The word the Lord is vibhu or omniscient. Omniscient also means all-knowing. So he's all-powerful and all-knowing. But the living entity is anu or atomic, very small. Because he's a living soul, he has the capacity to desire by his free will. We'll talk about this more later. Free will, very important concept. Such desires fulfilled only by the omnipotent Lord. And so when the living entity is bewildered in his desires, the Lord allows him to fulfill those desires, but the Lord is never responsible for the action and reaction of the particular situation which may be desired. Being in a bewildered condition, therefore, the embodied soul identifies himself with the circumstantial material body and becomes subjected to the temporary misery and happiness of life. The Lord is the constant companion of the living entity as Paramatma or Supersoul, and therefore he can understand the desires of the individual soul as one can smell the flavor of a flower by being near it. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning for the living entity. The Lord fulfills his desire as he deserves. Perhaps a desire and deserve. Man proposes and God disposes. The individual is not, therefore, omnipotent in fulfilling his desire. The Lord, however, can fulfill all desires, and the Lord, being neutral to everyone, does not interfere with the desires of the minute, independent living entity. However, when one desires Krishna, the Lord takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that one can attain to him and be eternally happy. Now, it's a long purport, but I'll stop at that point because I think this gives us a pretty good understanding so far of this general question. of the relationship of the omnipotent Lord and the living entities and its relationship to their particular happiness and distress in this material world. So I'm going to look at seven more verses, as I said. If you want to know, in advance, 2.10, 8.6, 4.11, 15.15, Srimad Bhagavatam 7.7.19, 7.19, and 10.10. So if you got this memorized, you can just read them at home and we're done. Okay. So the answer is, as I said, that God is both, Krishna is both omnipotent and loving and just. So there's some different perspectives on this. So I'm going to talk about, first of all, that only the body suffers and the soul remains eternally happy and blissful and is not affected by material suffering. Then we're going to talk about karma and transmigration of the soul. Without those concepts, you can't really answer this question satisfactorily. This is essential. Another essential component of understanding this is free will, and why free will is necessary for a loving relationship between Krishna and us, the Atma, the Jiva, the living entity. Then I'm going to talk about how Krishna rewards everybody and gives them what they desire, how he is equal to all, and how he does this personally, not just stands back and let it happen, but how he guides each Jiva, each of us living entities, through the heart, through all of our lives. And then ultimately, how Krishna wants to bring us back to him and shows his special kindness in guiding his devotees to come back home, back to him, and get out of this condition of material suffering. Okay? So that's where we're going in the next 25 minutes. First of all, there's a distinction of the soul, or called the self, or in Sanskrit, the jiva, or the atma, and the material body. Now, this is discussed very extensively. Bhagavad Gita, especially the second chapter, covers this very thoroughly. Just give a couple quick references. Very important verses in the second chapter, Bhagavad Gita, such as 2.20. For the soul, there is never birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So the importance of the distinction between the body and the soul. And then, of course, in the same series of verses, Krishna gives example of just as we change clothes, we grow out of a set of clothes when we're children and you get a new set, or your clothes wear out, you put on a new set of clothes, but it's still you within. You don't change when you change your clothes. So in the same way, the body is compared to a new set of clothes. So the soul remains within that body. We may change those bodies, but the soul continues on eternally. There's many, many examples throughout our literature. There's one that I liked. Actually, in the 10th canto, 54th chapter, there's a discussion where Balaram instructs Rukmini in spiritual matters. Now, this is kind of unusual. There aren't too many parts where Balaram is giving spiritual instruction, particularly Rukmini. He gives three examples of the difference between the body and the soul. I'll just talk about one. One is the phases of the moon, how it's changing, and even in the, what's it called when there's no moon? Is that the new moon or the new moon, right? So it appears as though the moon has disappeared, but it hasn't. It's simply out of our vision. So in the same way, upon death, it's not that the soul has died. It just simply is out of our vision and has gone to another place at that point. Then he gives the example of sleeping. When we're awake, we have a certain consciousness, and we think of that as our normal consciousness. But when we're asleep, we may dream, and we may have a very vivid dream, like a nightmare, and that is very, very real. When you're in the midst of it, it's very real. You're feeling the effect of that dream and all the emotions attached to it. You may be very frightened or whatever. So when you wake up, you know, well, that was just illusion. That wasn't real. But the memory may even continue when you're awake. So similarly, when we're very attached to the experiences of this body, of the senses and of the mental experiences, that bodily illusion continues. So even though it's not real in the sense that it's a temporary condition, it appears very real to us, just as we are waking from that vivid dream or from that nightmare. So sometimes the material world is compared to that, like a nightmare that hopefully we'll wake up from and regain our spiritual life and spiritual identity and understanding. You know, because the suffering that's here is like that. You know, it's temporary. It's not us, but it feels very, very real. Okay? So when we just say, okay, you're not your body, you're suffering, you have some pain, and in fact, those of us who are going to be my age, we understand very clearly the miseries of birth, death, disease, and old age, particularly the disease and old age part. You know, we're starting to experience that more and more, and death is coming closer and closer. So to say, well, you're not your body, those things aren't really happening to you, in one sense, that's true. It's 100% true, but even if the soul is aloof from material pain and pleasure, the conditioned consciousness certainly experiences suffering. We all have experienced that. Even if you're a devotee or a spiritualist or transcendentalist or whatever, and you know that you're not your body, you know, it's if you cut your hand, it hurts, right? In other words, the pain is real, and our consciousness, because the consciousness is a symptom of the soul. The soul has consciousness. It's part of us. It's part of the nature of the soul. So it is experiencing these things. So how do we understand it? Well, first we have to understand the concept of karma. We are experiencing happiness and distress due to reactions to our past actions. And we create the conditions for that suffering. We create the conditions that puts us in a particular body in this lifetime. And that came about from our last lifetime, particularly the consciousness of the time of death. Now here's another one of our verses, Bhagavad Gita 8:6. Yang yang vapi smaran bhavan tvaja chante kalevaram tang tang eveti kunteya sadat bhava bhavita. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. So it's the consciousness at the time of death that determines our next birth. So sometimes somebody thinks, well, that doesn't seem fair. What if I just happen to think of something, or, you know, I'm not thinking of something, or even I've been a devotee chanting Hare Krishna, you know, and something distracts me, or I'm in a lot of pain, and I may think, oh my God, this hurts so much, and then I die. Well, there's no tricks to this. Krishna's fair, you know. So one thing that Prabhupada explains in the purport, Prabhupada says, of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence the thoughts of the moment of death, so this life creates one's next life. So it's the entire span of the actions, the thoughts, the behaviors in this lifetime that create the conditions which will lead to a certain consciousness. Now, so what happens actually? What happens is we have the gross body, you know, all the elements, the senses, and we also have a subtle body, the mind, intelligence, and ego. So when the gross body dies, passes away, the soul travels on the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego. And that subtle body is then put into the womb of the mother in the next lifetime, in the next body, in the next birth. So when one, you know, then one comes with that consciousness still there. You might think, well, how is there continuity between the consciousness from the past life and the next life? Well, it's because the soul travels on the subtle body. And therefore, that's still there, and sometimes, you know, that same consciousness might be revived. In fact, we all know stories or experiences. Some people experience this themselves. Sometimes, you know, maybe not real clearly, but sometimes people have an idea, or they have a very strong sense of what their last lifetime, right? We all, you know, I shouldn't say we've all experienced that, but we know people, or we've heard of that experience. It's true. Because, you know, usually the consciousness is completely covered over by the trauma of birth, and one forgets one past lifetimes, but sometimes there still may be some remembrances. And think about things like phobias. Why are people, some people are just deathly afraid of thunderstorms and tornadoes or drowning, or why? Probably because that's how they passed away in a past life. So in other words, it may not be necessarily an absolute clear recollection. Oh, this happened to me, but there's still, there may be some of those traces that we can understand of the continuity of consciousness from one life to another. So at any rate, we receive our body due to the laws of nature, and those laws of nature are very stringent, which has to do with our actions and the reactions to those actions in our consciousness. In other words, the accumulation of past karma. So we create the body through our activities, which develops consciousness. All right? So in other words, we can't just blame God on everything. We had an active role in creating this body. So it's not that God is not fair if I got a particular body, because I'm responsible for that. So we also have to understand, of course, this cycle of transmigration of the soul and which we call samsara. I'll just read, how Prabhupada explained this very nicely in a purport to Bhagavatam 7.13.27. If one does not act for the satisfaction of Krishna, he must be entangled in the reactions of fruitive activities. By pious activities, one is elevated to the higher planetary systems, and by impious activities, one is degraded to the lower species of life, in which he is punished by the laws of nature. So then what happens? There you are. You're down in a dog body or a live oak tree body. In the lower species of life, there's an evolutionary process. So we believe in evolution, but not the type of evolution the scientists usually speak about, but spiritual evolution. When the term of the living entity's imprisonment or punishment in the lower species is finished, he is again offered a human form and given a chance to decide for himself in which way he should plan. So in other words, God is trying to be kind to living entities. Once one has suffered the karma, perhaps in a lower form of life, one is again offered the human form of life with another opportunity for spiritual life. Okay. And we transmigrate through as many as 8,400,000 different species of life. That's why Prabhupada so often talked about the value and the importance and necessity of this human form of life. Why? Because in the human form of life, one has enough intelligence and elevated consciousness to be able to take up spiritual life, to understand God, understand our relationship with God of service, and get out of this material world. In the animal form of life, we're not able to do this. Also, only the human form of life creates karma. When we are in bodies of plants and animals, microbes, whatever, we are simply living out the results of karma. And as I said, through that evolutionary process, going back up through these, it's like our punishment through these different bodies, again to the human form of life, where we again have the opportunity to either create more karma and go back down or to elevate ourselves. And that is by the free will of a living entity, which is our next concept, free will. Without free will, none of this works. There would be no fairness, there'd be no justice to Krishna's plan. The nature of the self, the Atma, is to possess free will. Why? Because Krishna has it, and we are all part and parcel of Krishna. We have similar qualities. God is very great, very large, full in all opulences. We are very small, so we have minute quantities of those qualities. I'm going to read from Srimad Bhagavatam 7.7.19. This is the actual Bhagavatam verse. It's very nice. Atma refers to the Supreme Lord or the living entity, either. Sometimes Atma can be used for God, or, like Atma or Paramatma. Both of them are spiritual, free from birth and death, free from deterioration, and free from material contamination. In other words, this is the pure state of the soul. They are individual. In other words, we're not all just one. I'm you and you and me, or we are all together, or whatever that was. I'm dating myself. No, we are individuals. Bhagavad Gita says, never there was a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Right? Eternally individual. They are knowers of the external body, and they are the foundation or shelter of everything. They are free from material change. They are self-illuminated. The soul is self-illuminated. They are the cause of all causes, and they are all-pervading. They have nothing to do with the material body, and therefore always uncovered. With these transcendental qualities, one who is actually learned must give up the illusory concept of life, in which one thinks, I am this material body, and everything in relationship to this body is mine. I'll just read a little bit of the purport. Srila Prabhupada says, he quotes the Bhagavad Gita, 15:7, the Lord clearly says, Maimaya Bang Cho Jivaloke Jivabhuta Sanatana. All the living entities are part of me. Therefore, the living entities are qualitatively the same as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the leader, the supreme amongst all living entities. Because the living entities are part or samples of God, their qualities are not different from those of the Supreme Lord. And then Prabhupada mentions, just like you take a drop of water out of the sea, that's the sample that you have. It has the same qualities as the whole ocean, but very small quantity. So, some of you heard this in a Bhagavatam class I read, but I don't think most of you. More about the Atma. This is from the Paramatma Sandarbha, one of the six Sandarbhas of Jiva Goswami, recently translated by Bhanu Swami. And in the Paramatma Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami talks about Paramatma, obviously, but the first half or two-thirds of the entire book is about the Atma. So he talks about the soul, and in the soul's relationship, the super-soul, Atma and Paramatma. So he makes a very strong point that the Atma is conscious, but not just conscious, but self-aware. In other words, we have consciousness of ourself. A little bit different, you know. Jiva Goswami is very philosophical. I usually have to read a passage about four times before I understand 20% of it. So it says, the Atma has Shakti. Shakti, your power. We're Sat, we're eternal, but we also are Chit. We have knowledge or awareness. So we have awareness of ourself as the Jiva and also awareness of all the objects in the material world. That awareness is coming from the soul. The senses themselves would not be aware. They are vehicles which brings information, which is then filtered through the mind and intelligence, but ultimately it's the soul that is conscious. The soul pervades the body and gives consciousness to the body. Prabhupada gave this example so many times. What's the difference between a live body and a dead body? The soul is gone. That's what it pervades the body. It gives life, gives consciousness, everything. The Atma is also an enjoyer. Third part, Satchitananda, is Ananda. We enjoy bliss. The Atma also has desire. We have our own desires. And also, he quotes many verses from many scriptures about how the Atma is a doer, or the cause of one's own action. So being an actor, a doer, implies that there is volition or free will. Brahma Sutra says, the pure Jiva has the nature of a doer by his Shakti, along with his senses. Like a carpenter, the Jiva is a doer. Just as a carpenter uses an axe, the Jiva is a doer using his Shakti. The Jiva is an agent. Okay? So the Atma sounds like we got all kinds of power, don't we? Well, no. It's actually quite limited. Because we have Shakti, but we're called Tatashta Shakti. Tatashta Shakti is not the same as Paramatma, who is full power, full Shakti. In fact, any power we have is coming from Paramatma. But Tatashta means that we may become covered by Maya, by the modes of nature. And Prabhupada gives an example of a Tatashta. He said, just like if you go to the beach, and you're right there at the edge of the water, and you see the tide comes in, sometimes the spot of sand, sometimes it's covered by water, therefore it's ocean. Sometimes the tide recedes, and it's land. So it depends upon the covering. So we have the tendency to become covered by the ignorance of this material energy or prakriti. That's the difference between us and God. God cannot become covered. God is the controller of prakriti. But we can become controlled by prakriti, even though that is not our essential original nature. Okay? So now, why must there be free will? Doesn't this bring about suffering in the material world? Prabhupada often says it's our misuse of free will which has brought us to this material world. So why does he just not allow that? Make us so that we don't have that free will and we're always happy and enjoy with him. Well, we'd be missing one very important emotional ingredient. Somebody say it? Love, yeah. Where would the love be? It wouldn't be true love. This is an interesting conversation. This is in Potomac, and I guess I must have been there, but I don't remember. Well, maybe I wasn't in the room at this time. This was when probably came in 1976 to Potomac, Maryland. This is a long time ago, 42 years, wow. Anyway, Prabhupada was, says, so even in Vaikuntha, if I desire, why shall I serve Krishna? Why not do I become Krishna? I may immediately fall down. That is natural. A servant is serving the master. Sometimes they think, I could become the master. They are trying to become God, but that is delusion. You cannot become God. So there was a devotee there. I think it was our vice president named Vipina or Vipina Purandara. I don't know. I haven't seen him for a long time, but so Vipina, this is all Vipina talking to him. Vipina says, why doesn't Krishna protect us from that desire? Prabhupada said, he is protecting. He says, you rascal, don't desire, surrender to me. But you don't do this. Vipina, why doesn't he save me from thinking like that? Prabhupada, that means you lose your independence. And Vipina says, and no love. You got it right. Prabhupada said, that would be force. Is it love? You love me, otherwise I will kill you. Is that love? So Krishna does not want to become a lover like that on the point of a revolver. You love me or I'll kill you. No, that is not love. That is threatening. Love is reciprocal, voluntary, good exchange of feeling. Then there is love, not by force. Vipina, but isn't it by force anyway? Because if you don't love Krishna, we suffer. Prabhupada, that is your business. You suffer. Krishna does not force you. He says you love and you'll be happy. If you don't love, you suffer. That is your business. Sounds like we all made some bad choices, doesn't it? Yeah. So, we chose not to love Krishna. We came to this material world and we suffer. So, Krishna gives everyone what they desire and what they deserve. He's impartial. He's impartial to everyone. He's fair. He's all-powerful, he's all-knowing, he's also fair. So the question is, how can Krishna understand the suffering of a conditioned jiva? Well, at least Jiva Goswami raises that question. And he talks about an important Bhagavatam verse. It's interesting. This is a verse 10.10.14. It said, I forget who's speaking. Anyway, by seeing their faces, one whose body has been pricked by pins can understand the pain of others who are pinpricked. Realizing the pain is the same for everyone, he does not want others to suffer in this way. But one who has never been pricked by pins cannot understand this pain. So this is kind of the nature of empathy being talked about in the Srimad Bhagavatam. If we experience pain, we can appreciate and understand in others. We see another person is experiencing suffering. We know that suffering. We can empathize and you know, respond accordingly. Now, Krishna doesn't have a material body. Krishna doesn't have material emotions. Krishna does not ever suffer. He is always happy and blissful. So, can he understand the suffering of the living entities? Or Jiva Goswami says, is he simply indifferent? Well, he answers this, that Krishna fully knows our suffering. He's omniscient. He's in our hearts. He understands everything. He completely knows and understands the experience of suffering and living entity, but he does not personally experience the suffering. Okay? I mean, sometimes you probably have all had an experience where somebody you knew or a friend or something was really going through something difficult, and you can understand. You could see how they were suffering, but you may not have actually ever had that experience yourself exactly, right? So Krishna's like that. He fully knows our suffering, but rather he tries to bestow his mercy on the jivas. So, he impartially acts for the good of everyone. Another verse, Bhagavad Gita, 4.11. Yeyatam angprapadyante tangs tadayava bhajamiham mam mamavartmanavartante manusha pardisarvasha. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, Sanaparta. Interesting. He's not saying just devotees. He's saying everyone follows my path. Because as they surrender or not, he rewards accordingly. So, Prabhupada says in the purport, everyone is searching for Krishna in different aspects of his manifestation. His impersonal Brahmajyoti effulgence and all-pervading supersoul dwelling within everything, including the particles of atoms. But Krishna is fully realized by his devotees. As for those impersonalists who want to commit spiritual suicide by annihilating their individual existence of the living entity, in other words, those who are like often some of the more extreme versions of Buddhism, like Zen, talk about this, or Mayavadi philosophy, basically the extinction of the soul. That's what they're talking about. Did you completely obliterate or eliminate any individual distinction of the soul and somehow become part of one undifferentiated spiritual mass, whatever that means. By the way, if you ever find it hard to understand impersonal philosophy or Mayavadi philosophy, the reason is Vishwanath Chakravarti explains it. He says, because you can't understand it because it doesn't make any sense. Okay, just so we have that out of the way. Anyway, for those impersonalists, what does he do? He absorbs them into his effulgence. That's what they want? Okay, they come to the Brahmajyoti. For those who are yogis seeking mystic powers, he awards them that. For those who are fruitive workers, the Lord awards the desired result of their prescribed duties. If they perform very good works, they go to the heavenly planets. So, by his mercy alone, all kinds of spiritual processes are but a different degree of success on the same path. So sometimes people say, yeah, well, there's so many paths, all paths. Yeah, there are. There's so many paths, but they don't all go to the same place. In other words, I can't take I-75, go out here and head north and go to Ocala very easily at least, or go south and end up in Atlanta. No, you can take a lot of different paths, but they're not necessarily going to lead to the same place. They're going to lead to the destination that path takes you. So, does Krishna arrange all of this? Is this all under Krishna's control? Or is it an automatic mechanical process? That's another way sometimes people answer these questions. They say, well, whatever happens, it's just mechanical. It's just by karma. Of course, the karma mamamsa was the philosophy we heard about in the Govardhan Leela. That's talked about there a lot because Krishna pretended to speak this karma mamamsa philosophy, which is basically everything's mechanical. You get whatever you get. You know, you do pious activities, you're going to get a result. You don't even have to worry about God. You just do what you do and you're going to get the reaction. But actually, that's not true, because Krishna is in control of all these situations. Of course, our last verse, Bhagavad Gita 4.11, said that, you know, that basically that he was in control. That let's read that one again. As they surrender me, I reward accordingly. So in other words, he is rewarding. And then we have a very important verse, 15.15. Sarvashi chaham hridi sanivishto mataksmatir gyanam aponam cha vidaischa sarva raham eva vejo vidanta kridveda vireva chaham. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness, all coming from Krishna. By all the Vedas I am to be known, I am the compiler of Vedanta and the knower of the Vedas. So after, you know, Krishna gives these different vibhutis, he's talking about, I'm the light and the sun and the moon, like that. Then he kind of switches gears in 15.15, and he talks about his personal relationship with us, how the Paramatma is in the heart of every living entity, the source of remembering everything, including remembering Krishna, of knowledge and also forgetting. And here, in the purport, Prabhupada discusses the relationship to the transmigration of different bodies, how the jiva forgets his past lifetime due to the power of Krishna, but his state of consciousness is restored. In other words, the forgetfulness and remembrance all given by Krishna, and then how our current consciousness prepares for future bodies. We already discussed that point. So there's this continuity of level of consciousness, and this whole process is maintained, conducted, and under the control of Krishna, the Supreme Lord. Okay, so Krishna knows and directs every living entity's existence. He is omnipotent and omniscient, also omnipresent. Get all the omnis in here. Omnipresent means he's located everywhere through the Brahman effulgence and through the Paramatma, which pervades throughout the universe and goes into the heart of every living entity. So, his control, he says, 1861, we're going to. says Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridishar Junatishati Brahmayan Sarvabhutani Yantarudani Mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine, the body, made of the material energy. So Krishna is directing the wanderings of all living entities. So a very nice purport there. And Vishwanathacharya Thakur's purport to that particular verse, he talks about there's two parts to it. First of all, that Krishna helps all living entities in this material world. How does he do that? Well, how does every animal out there find their next meal? It's all coming from Krishna. Actually, you know this concept of instinct? You've all heard of instinct, right? Why does a bird fly south in the winter? Because of instinct. Now, what does that mean? Doesn't mean anything, does it? Just one of those words they throw out, you know? So now, oh, yeah, I get it. It's instinct. Well, what is it? Prabhupada actually said what instinct is. He said it's a combination of learned behavior and Krishna's super soul within the heart of that particular animal or whatever directing them. So that's what instinct is, really. It's Krishna directing through the heart. So first he helps every living entity in their sojourn through this material world. And secondly, he specifically helps us to achieve liberation, to get out of this material world. So he helps us while we're here and then helps us to get out. How? Because Krishna sends the Vedas. And that's what he's talking about in 1515, by all the Vedas I am to be known. In other words, Krishna can be known by his revealed scriptures that he sends. This is part of Krishna's kindness. He sends his revealed scriptures. He comes himself, many, many avatars, incarnations. Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the most munificent incarnation, appeared only 500 years ago and gave us the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, the Yuga Dharma, or the process of self-realization for this age. He comes up and he sends the great acharyas, the gurus, the spiritual masters, the sages and saints who help to instruct us in spiritual knowledge. So in all of these ways, Krishna comes, Krishna sends his representatives to bring us back to him. Because that is his desire. His desire is for everyone to return to him. Bhagavad Gita 7:19 says, after many births and deaths, he who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. Well, I think what's important is after many births and deaths, we may be in this material world many lifetimes. But if one shows a little spark, a little bit of desire to return to Krishna, to get out of this material world, then Krishna sends all help. Krishna inspires that living entity, inspires us in the heart to take up spiritual life, to try to understand him. Or, if we are sincere, he will send the guru, the spiritual master, to help take us out of this material world. So, Krishna particularly tries to help the devotee, one who has surrendered to him, one who wants to get out, one wants to understand spiritual knowledge, one who wants to become enlightened and free from the material bondage, the cycle of birth and death of samsara. Krishna gives them special help. So my final verses from the Bhagavad Gita 10:10 and 10:11. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give them the understanding by which they can come to me. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in the heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much. So, questions, comments, thoughts?
Sorry. Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you so much for this amazing class. I was taking down notes, and you know, there are so many ideas that are going right now through me, so maybe you can help me. When we say that gunas are conditioning us, right?
Did they what?
When we were saying that gunas are conditioning us,
okay.
Do we mean only that they condition the they condition us to like questions like, okay, do you want pizza or do you want pasta or do you want dal? You know, and depending on the mode, you know, I'm going to choose whatever.
Yeah.
And is it only for that, or is it also for things like you know, do I choose to serve Krishna?
Well,
like what? Where is the free will in terms of gunas?
Yeah, yeah. In other words, the gunas act in many ways. In fact, on very deep levels, the modes of nature discussed in a chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, and how they affect so many different aspects of our life, of higher consciousness, you know, activities, as well as like your choices of what you want to eat and things like that. And of course, those it's described that those different activities, behaviors, thoughts can be classified in those different modes of nature. Now, basically, when we're talking about free, I'm going to just go back a little bit. When we talk about free will, if you really come down to it, there's really sort of, you got one basic choice to begin with. That's, do I serve Krishna or not serve Krishna? Do I want to leave Krishna? Do I want to serve myself? Do I want to try to enjoy independently of Krishna or be in a loving relationship with Krishna? That was our first independent free will choice. Once we decide we want to leave Krishna, or we don't want to serve Krishna, Prabhupada said, we want to be the master, not the servant, then what happens? We're thrown into this material world. It's described as two potencies, the throwing and the covering potency. We're thrown into this material energy, and then we're covered. And the first contact, the point of contact with material energy is ahankara, false ego, right? So first of all, because there must be false ego. There must be false identification. Otherwise, we'd be here in this material world going, wait a minute, I'm not serving a Krishna. I'm supposed to be back there in Goloka Vrindavan. I'm supposed to be playing with Krishna. No. We have to be covered over, identify with this body we've been given, both gross body and the subtle body, the mind and intelligence. Now, that particular gross and subtle body is basically under the control of the gunas, of the three modes of nature in different combinations, goodness, passion, ignorance. We might be predominantly goodness and have a body as a demigod or whatever, you know, or a very pious person, a human being in the material world. Or we may be primarily in ignorance and have an animal body or plant body. So, yeah, once we've come in this material world, made the decision, then we are controlled by the gunas, and the specific combination of gunas, again, dictated by our karma. So according to our karma from our past lifetime, a certain consciousness is there. A consciousness continues into the next lifetime and therefore influenced by the material modes of nature. Now, fortunately, the process of Krishna consciousness or spiritual life, you know, cuts through those. It's described right in the second chapter about how the Hriday Granthi, the knot in the heart, those gunas are cut by the process of bhakti yoga or devotional service.
Can I have a follow-up question?
Go ahead. Then we'll see if somebody else... We'll give you one, and then we're going to go on.
Okay. So, let's say that somebody brings up an argument, you know, that I'm faced with somebody that's saying, like, well, it seems like this choice to choose Krishna is more a thing of sattva guna. You know, that just because, you know, you've been, you know, living in a certain way like that, because of that.
If one is situated in mode of goodness, one is more likely to take to spiritual life. It's the platform.
So how is it not just like, oh, well, you know, it's not transcendental. It's just, you know, it's just mundane. It's just material.
Okay, because ultimately, Krishna consciousness is transcendental to the modes of nature. It's in what we call shuddha-sattva, or pure goodness. And pure goodness is quite different than the mode of goodness. Mode of goodness brings us to that stage of happiness based upon good activities. And Prabhupada talks about that in that chapter of the modes of nature. He talks about those in the mode of goodness, conditioned to the mode of goodness, philosophers, philanthropists, scientists like that, they might lead a very good life. And they may be sort of enjoying a certain happiness. You know, we see people like that. You know, maybe they're even vegetarians, they're well situated, but they may not have any connection with God or relationship with God. Therefore, they're not actually in transcendental or shuddha-sattva. So, but at the same time, being in the mode of goodness gives one a better opportunity because the intelligence is in a higher position, is more clear, a better opportunity to take advantage when by the mercy of Krishna, the Guru, the Holy Name, that opportunity is given to us. Okay? We could go on forever on this topic. You know, I mean, no, it's those are great questions. Those are really, really important topics to discuss. Thank you so much for that. Let's go over to the ladies' side. I think we have a Gatmika.
Thank you. Did you say that Krishna does not feel our pain?
Krishna does not experience our pain because he doesn't have a material body, and he doesn't experience pain in that way. But he understands our pain. He knows it. I don't know if I fully understand it because I'm not Krishna, and I don't know, you know what he's experiencing. You know, but I'm at least intellectually, I'm trying to say. In other words, he can't experience material suffering because how can he? He doesn't have a material body. He's not suffering. He's always in bliss. He's always fully satisfied. He's Atmarama, on and on. But at the same time, he's fully cognizant, right? He's omniscient. He knows everything. He's within our heart. He's traveling, living it through every lifetime. So he knows it. Yeah? Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Hare Krishna. I was reflecting earlier today on a question that I asked my grandma when I was 10, when my grandfather died. And you kind of summed up the question today.
Okay.
Which I know from reading through the philosophy, but it was nice to hear it because... So I asked my grandma when I was 10, when grandpa died, I said... because, by the way, raised as a traditional Catholic, this was the funeral services, and we were on the way to the cemetery. So I said to grandma, well, how do you know? You know, how do you know he's just going to go back to heaven? I mean, what if he did one thing wrong? And I was hushed, needless to say. There was never an answer given to me in all those years.
Don't ask questions like that.
Till I met, you know, Krishna devotees, you know. Luckily, yeah. I found this answer now. But,
yeah.
But I just was thinking about that question today, and I thought, where would you be if you didn't have this knowledge? I mean, that we've been so lucky to be shared because I kept thinking, after asking Grandma that and not finding that answer, like, I would be really, we'd be in trouble. Like, we only have, like, this one lifetime to get everything perfect, and I thought, I'm never going to go home to see God, you know?
Yeah. So I've always wondered that. Sometimes when I've been, not very often, but sometimes I've had to go to a funeral with a relative. It's usually a Christian funeral, you know? And you invariably they'll say, and Joe went is now with the Lord, with Jesus in heaven. Hey, well, how do they know that? You know? In other words, we don't know what kind of activities. Now, if he did some pious activities, yes, he could be elevated to a pious activity. But you know, in Kali Yuga, meat eating, I mean, what are the odds? Probably not real good, are they? So yeah, I think sometimes it's kind of wishful thinking. And so we're optimistic. We have a wonderful process that elevates everyone. Everyone can become, you know, everyone can go back to Godhead. At the same time, we're realistic. We know that it takes certain things. Prabhupada said desire, but deserve. In other words, karma is desire and deserve. In other words, we have to do those actions, you know, that are going to elevate us. We can't just, you can't just think about it. Yeah, so... yeah, you know, it's, and I guess that's what I was trying to say in the beginning, that I think I also believe we're very, very fortunate that we have this philosophy that can really explain these deep questions. So like when our children come to us and say, well, what's happening? Well, we have something to tell them, you know, and it makes sense. And it's usually pretty satisfying to people when they hear a Krishna conscious explanation. Because these are life and death. These are important questions. They're the big ones. Okay. Yes, Prabhu. Good to see you. Microphone.
If this creation, if Krishna desires our liberation, and if Krishna's desires are never go in vain, how is it that we can have indeed free will? Because we're combating Krishna in one sense, so is there obviously our free will is limited compared to his. And in which case, is there any meaning to when Prabhupada mentions about the eternally conditioned nityabhadas? What is it?
Nityabhada, nityasiddha. Yeah, eternally conditioned. Yeah, in fact, this is there are verses that say there are two types of souls. Those are eternally conditioned. However, even though we've been at eternally conditioned stage. By the mercy of Guru and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we can get out of that stage. In fact, it is this... what was the first thing you said? I lost your first point.
you remember the design of the, if Krishna desires our liberation.
Oh, okay. Krishna's desire for our liberation. Yeah, he does, but he also respects our desires. That's the whole point of independence or free will, right? That whole idea that, in other words, whatever our desire is, he's rewarding accordingly. He's fulfilling our desires, even though his desire would be for us to return back to him. Therefore, that's why if the living entity makes any attempt, some small attempt, to turn towards Krishna, Krishna will reciprocate. Prabhupada said, if we take one step to Krishna, Krishna takes 10 steps towards us.
So can we say the cards are stacked against us?
Well, being in the material world, Kali Yuga, it's kind of rough, but we got some one really great thing going for us. The appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, being in the golden age of Lord Chaitanya, and his incredible mercy, being the most, you know, magnanimous, munificent incarnation of God, making this very easy process of chanting Hare Krishna. I mean, what more could we want, given that the deck stacked against us? You know, here we are. That's the proof, right? In other words, I can just speak for myself. I don't have any special qualification. I don't think I was some great yogi or some great anything. But somehow or another, here we are, performing devotional service. Not just devotional service, but the highest pure devotional service given by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, through the disciplic succession from Prabhupada. You know, not mixed devotional service, not demigod worship, not, you know, pure devotional service. We're doing it. Somehow. Go ahead.
Well, from whence comes the question? Is it our mechanical perspective? If the design of the creation, which is all loving, all just, all Sri Bhagavan,
yeah,
then can we say that liberation is guaranteed for all the living entities eventually? I mean, can we? Because it was mentioned a couple of weeks ago.
Really achieved? Yeah.
That there's
Samahatma Sadurlaba, right? Such a great soul. Sadurlaba, very rare. Very rare. Yeah.
But is it a fact that everyone will go back to Godhead?
That is what we hear, particularly in the pastime of Lord Chaitanya and Vasudeva Dutta, who was the incarnation of Prahlada Maharaj. When he said, I want to, let me stay here in the material, he had such great compassion. He said, let me stay in the material world, let me take everyone's sins, and let them all go back. And Lord Chaitanya appreciated the wonderful, compassionate sentiment, but he said, but you don't need to do this. He said, I've already liberated everyone. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu indicated that, I don't know how many lifetimes, you know, the exact mechanisms, how long will it take, but yes, Lord Chaitanya is liberating everyone in the material world. Eventually, sooner or later, we will come back. Prabhupada said that also.
Is this even a question because of our mechanical conditioning and identifying and relating to this yantra? Or why does this question even arise in one sense?
Is it because of our mechanical conditioning that, we doubt it or we wonder about it?
Well, the wonder about it because it's...
Oh, yeah. Well, no, it is wondrous. I mean, it's... In other words, the unlimited compassion of God and his pure devotees is not a small thing. You know, we sometimes say it a lot, we hear it a lot, so we think, oh yeah, devotees are very compassionate, Krishna's very compassionate. But when you really think about it, like you're asking in a very profound way, yes, it's pretty amazing. It's very wondrous. And which should induce even greater appreciation on our part, in our hearts, right? In other words, my God, what did Prabhupada give me? I can barely understand it, you know? That kind of mercy. Yeah. Yeah, let's go over. Yamaraj, Prabhu.
Thank you for your class, Prabhu. When you were speaking about desire, I had an experience the other day. It was Friday. So a gentleman got in my car, Uber driver, and he got in, and he was going to the airport. So I have my Bhagavad Gita Higher Taste on the side, side panels of the car. So when he got in, he was on the way to Russia, too. And so he told me, he says, oh, are you a Hindu? Because I was playing bhajan. So I told him, no. He said, well, this book, Bhagavad Gita, I've been waiting for this book all my life.
So you became a Hindu real quick. No.
Yeah, but you know, it was amazing when you said that. You know, you said, I've been waiting for this book all my life, you know. And so it's like, you know, like what you're saying. So and we talked about it, cleaning on up till you got to the airport, about Christian consciousness and everything. And he had some very nice questions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing is like you said, if you have a desire, then Christian will somehow or other send somebody
absolutely.
To facilitate that desire.
And I'll bet every one of us has a couple stories like that where we know about people came just by incredible ways and somehow, you know, Krishna sends us. I tell my own story, so I won't tell mine because, you know, you've all heard all my stories. But we're getting late, and I know people want to take prasadam. They're already lining up in here. If there's a final question I'll take, if anyone really feel free to go if you need to go. You won't be, you know, you won't be rude. But if somebody wants to answer, so that's the question. Looks like we got a couple still. Is that right, Kurt?
I was just going to say that Krishna's really intelligent. Why would he create somebody to suffer forever?
Why does he what?
Why would he create some living entity to suffer forever?
Right.
Because Krishna is so intelligent, he's created everybody to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously he doesn't want us to stay in the material world forever. So he's always making arrangements for us to go back to the spiritual world. So, you know, everybody gets liberated sooner or later because Krishna he's not stupid, didn't create people to suffer forever.
That's another nice perspective on it, because I was thinking back when I was talking about those qualities of the soul and our, in other words, the original dormant, late, you know, qualities that are within us are so amazing. Why would Krishna want us to, like, squander those and just stay here? In other words, we have what we call our sarup, our sanatan dharma, our constitutional position, which is to be, you know, free, liberated souls in relationship with Krishna in devotional service. So, yeah, that's what
that's
Krishna
what
wants. Krishna wants to complete that, have us come back to that original position.
Yeah, that's what I say to Christians who believe in eternal hell. That, you know, that means God is stupid because he's created people to suffer forever, and he must be...
Well, either stupid or he's cruel.
He's stupid and he's cruel.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, that's the problem with eternal damnation. What does it say about God? Yeah, so no, we don't accept eternal damnation. Right. Okay. All right. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.